Hey, Prepper Recon fans, welcome to another edition of the PrepperRecon.com podcast. Our mission is to bring you great interviews with preppers from around the globe so you can be better informed and better prepared for everything from a hurricane to the end of the world as we know it. Today's guest is the author of the new book, The Wayward Journey, Nathan Jefferson. Nathan, thanks for coming on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. My pleasure. When did you wake up to the need to prepare?
It was actually probably about 4 or 5 years ago. I was doing some work with the state level Department of Homeland Security, and I was seeing a lot of the workup for the 2011 exercise, which was about the New Madrid earthquake. Up until then, you know, I'd heard of that earthquake zone before, but never knew its breadth or scope. So I started looking into that. I ended up watching the crash course on peakprosperity.com and just really got my eyes open to how fragile our society really is.
Yeah, the Peak Prosperity's crash course is really, really good. I'm a big fan of Chris Martinson. I listen to his podcast every week. It's a really level-headed presentation of some of the challenges that our society's facing.
And right.
All the way from economics to resource scarcity to the political challenges and everything else. So tell us a little bit about the book, Nathan.
The book follows John, who is just a normal family man who takes a job traveling across the country working for the oil companies. There's a lot of turmoil going around through the country. Inflation's rampant, you know, so that part of the story is completely fictional. There's an oil shortage where oil prices are going through the roof. So that one's also completely fictional. And then the center of the country is devastated by a pair of really strong earthquakes from the New Madrid seismic zone, which do a lot of damage up through the Illinois, Tennessee, Arkansas kind of area and really brings the whole country to a standstill. And then it follows him over the next couple of weeks as he's trying his best to make it home from over 2,000 miles away to his family after this has happened.
And then you say that inflation, the high inflation is completely fictional. I guess if you believe our government's numbers that inflation's only 2%, I guess then it's fictional. But there's some other numbers out there that don't really jive with what the government's telling us on inflation.
Yeah, it's I'm sorry, I was trying to be a little tongue-in-cheek.
I usually, yeah, I kind of got that. I kind of figured that.
But, you look at the CPI over the past decade, and it's kind of averaged out to about 2%. You can look at some of the other ones. I love, you know, John Williams over at Shadow Stats.
Yeah, he does great work.
He's shown, if you base it on the 1990 base, it's about 6% over the past year, you know, past decade. Or if you go off an 18 or 1980 base, it's about 8%. So you're looking about 6 to 8%, you know, versus a 2% average. And that's scary. You know, you tell that to the normal person on the street and they're like, oh, it's a couple of percentage points, but it compounds so much over every year that, you know, my wife notices when we go to the grocery store and, you know, we used to walk out of Walmart or Meijer or wherever we're going shopping and, you know, the bill would be, you know, 70, 80 bucks. Now we get the exact same stuff and it's 120, 130. It's, you know, really starting to affect a lot of people. And, you know, the numbers that people are reading on the headline news don't really add up to what they're seeing on the ground.
Yeah. They keep changing the measuring stick that they use to measure inflation. Like you mentioned, you said if we use the same metrics that we used in 1980 for today, then we'd have 8%. Is that what you said?
I think that's if you're looking at a 1980 basket, if you're looking at the price of some goods in 1980 versus 1990, then using the same unadjusted inflation stats they used to use back, I think if they changed it in like 94 or 97. But another one that I like to look at is they've shown like a grocery basket or a Walmart basket. I can't remember what they call it. And it's gone up so much over the past, you know, 4 or 5 years that it's crazy.
That's crazy.
One of my favorite things about the inflation is most people, that you talk to, I'm going to hope and guess that a lot of your listeners probably know this, but they really, really, you know, play with those numbers when you're looking at the inflation rate. You know, energy and healthcare are weighted so little. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites is healthcare. If you look at the GDP of the country, is about 20%. And when you look at the CPI inflation, you know, calculations, I think it's 1.5 or 2.5% of that calculation. And then you have all the wonderful games of hedonics and substitution that they love to play.
Oh yeah, yeah. So substitution is where if steak goes up from $8 to $20, then I'll go buy chicken, which is $6. So actually, my basket went down.
Right.
In the eyes of the BLS.
Right, and then you go from
the LBS, as I like to call it, lots of BS.
Yeah, Bureau of Lies and Statistics.
Yeah.
And then you go, you know, not only did your basket go down because you saved $2 eating chicken, but then next time when it comes around, you're buying hot dogs for $5 and it goes down again.
So,
and then you end up buying dog food or cat food for $4 and it goes down again.
Yep. It just keeps getting better and better. What have we got to complain about, right?
Hey, Fancy Feast tastes great.
Oh yeah, with ketchup. And then they use hedonics, which is where, if I buy a computer today, it's got so many more features on it that even though I paid more for it, I'm getting more pleasure derived from the computer because now it does so many more things than the computer that I would have paid $100 less for 5 years
right.
ago. It's actually cheaper.
Yeah, and other good examples are, you know, that I like to throw out there are TVs. You know, even though your TV's costing more, it's a bigger flat screen, and it's a flat screen and has different features. So you might be paying the same price, but the weighting they give it goes down. Or cell phones. I mean, you know, I can't remember what my first cell phone bill was. I think it was only like $29 a month or something like that, but you know, now I've got a plan that's almost $100 a month because you have to have data, you have to have texting, you have to have all different kinds of things that, you know, you don't have to, but I use it for work, so I do have it. But it keeps going up and up, but they keep rating that as a savings because I'm getting so much more bang for my buck, even though the cost has gone up 3 times.
Yeah. And then I was reading the first chapter of the book, and it looks like in one of the news headlines that inflation's starting to kick in the wayward journey.
Yeah, it really is.
To consider tightening and start thinking about raising interest rates.
Yeah, that's one of the things. You know, the people are when they can't finally lie about it anymore. It's kind of like the point where the book starts. You know, right now 6% and 8%. People are feeling that pain, but the majority of people still believe that there's not a lot of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start seeing double digit or, you know, multiples going up per year, or you start seeing changes, you know, month to month, eventually people kind of catch on to that. And, you know, that's where the book kind of starts. And later on in the book, you kind of get a little hints from what the government's trying to do to stave off that kind of collapse. One of the things that I point out in there is, you know, I think it was back in, was it 2008 or 2009? It was like one of the very last things Bush did was to send out the $600 checks to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the indicators I think everybody should keep their eyes on. Once they start doing that again, you know that there's something big afoot.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Goldman and Chase want to keep all those checks for themselves.
Well, they're just going to take they're going to get a processing fee on every one of them anyway.
Yeah, so. they're getting commission on all of the U.S. bonds that are sold, and they're getting I think, Goldman's handles most of the transactions for the bonds, and I mm-hmm. think, Chase handles all the EBT cards, and they get a per swipe transaction fee for every EBT.
Yep.
Swipe, so.
And a management fee on top of that. It's, of course they want to keep giving out money. They'll be happy to cash everybody's $600 checks when they get a big slice of it.
Absolutely.
That's the way, you know, Wall Street works. Like, it's fine. We'll let everybody have all of their money. We're just going to take this small little sliver of it. Mm-hmm. But when it's a small little sliver of every single transaction, that's when it really starts to add up.
Yeah, and then I read the main character in the book, John. He's stumped. He's trying to draft a letter to his employer to ask for a raise, and he can't think of how much to ask for because inflation's moving so fast that it's a moving target. He can't really think of a good figure.
Well, it's not just inflation. It's also, you know, the unemployment and the job market. You know, the headline unemployment rate, I think, is 7.5. But if you, once again, quoting John Williams over Shadow Stats, I think he shows it if you were to measure it the same way they did, you know, back before, I don't even know exactly the method, but the same method they used back during the Great Depression, it shows it about 23%, very comparable to the unemployment we had in the Great Depression. So, you know, kind of throw that out there is, you know, you've got a good job, and he's working, and into the book, he's working for one of these oil companies that's making banks. You know, they've got money, they hired him, paying him well, but, you know, not well enough. And he's working long hours, which is another, you know, new America thing where if you're either getting your hours cut because they have to get underneath a 30 or 32 hour minimum so they don't have to give you health care, or they're going to load you with as many hours as they can to, you know, use you and abuse you to have as few FTEs as they can and pay as few other fees and healthcare benefits as they can. So while he's trying to draft this, you know, I'm trying to convey, he's trying to think of what's fair to me and what can I kind of, I don't want to say get away with, but what's fair to me and what's fair to the company.
Sure.
You know, in this kind of environment where, you know, prices are going up and, but there's also a big pile of people out there looking for work.
Mm-hmm. And then John in the book has to travel a lot for work.
Mm-hmm.
You said he's a, I'm sorry, can you tell us again what he does? He works for oil companies.
Yeah, he's a professional engineer. So his role at the sites is actually going and kind of signing off on all the, like drill sites. Generally when you have those kinds of sites and, depending on where you are and what the setups look like, you need somebody who's a certified engineer in the state to sign off before you can move forward. And that's a highly sought after skill, you know, not only now, but probably going forward because you have to have an advanced engineering degree plus, I think it's about a half a dozen years of experience to back that up. So that's his role going from site to site, kind of being the quality inspector.
And then you mentioned that, another one of the catalysts for the collapse in the book, we talked about inflation. And then you said also another thing that happens in the book is there's a major earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the New Madrid fault zone?
Yeah, the New Madrid seismic zone, which is, down, the easiest way to find it is it's right next to Memphis. Mm-hmm. Kind of in the, Memphis, Little Rock, St. Louis kind of area.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the, most active fault zones in the U.S. I sent over a couple of links to some pictures, and you can kind of see the damage area. Hopefully you can pop those up on the podcast
so the
listeners can see.
So they can look at
and the range and breadth of this is kind of scary. It's responsible for 3 of the 5 largest earthquakes to ever hit the, well, not ever, but in recorded history to hit the continental U.S., and not only are they the strongest, but they're also some of the strongest, but they're the widest spread. You can see a spread from all the way down, you know, you're going to see damage from the tops of Louisiana down all the way to, you know, the middle or even above that in, Illinois through Indiana, Kentucky, lots in Tennessee. It's a really big area. And it's got a potential for some really big, you know, 8+ on the Richter scale kind of, earthquakes. And if you look at the USGS reports and other reports, they say it's a very highly likelihood. You know, I see a couple of the reports in the, actually in the 2011 national level exercise from DHS after action report. They state that there's a 90% chance that in the next 50 years, there'll be a earthquake of at least a magnitude of 6 in this area.
Wow. 90% chance.
90% chance.
Years.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And 6, and so they put it, they said that as a level, as a number 6, but the average they usually get is about 7.5 or to 8, I think. When you're looking at some of the bigger ones, they had you know, 7.7, 7.7, 7.5, and then lots of sevens, you know, that are mixed in there in high sixes. So it's due for a big one here, according to, you know, the good guys at, you know, USGS and other research places. Then you can look, get on YouTube and you can see a lot of the, you know, I don't want to pick on them, but I'll just call them the tinfoil hat crowd, and they'll show how it splits the country in half and water goes from, you know, Lake Michigan all the way down to the Gulf.
Wow.
And that's, you know, maybe a little out of the realm of possibility in the short term, but not in the long term.
Maybe that would give us a, maybe that'd split us into two continents and we could have a two-state solution then, and that would, alleviate some of our political turmoil.
You'd have the Northeast still kind of calling the shots on the right side and California probably calling the shots on the left side. So I think it'd be two ships with the same steering.
Yeah. That wouldn't be good, would it? And so when we had Katrina, I mean, that was a bad disaster, but it was one little localized area, and FEMA was a complete failure on that. How did things look in the after action review on that national level exercise that you were talking about?
It wasn't rosy. I don't think it was a complete failure, but it wasn't rosy by any means. You know, they estimated, you know, a moderate, I can't remember exactly what it was right offhand, I should have wrote that down, but I think it was like a 6-9 or maybe a 7, low 7 earthquake. And in that estimate, they had estimated there'd be at least 75,000 casualties, over $200 billion worth of damage, and, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people displaced from damaged buildings. And that's on a smaller side if the earthquake isn't as big as, you know, average. But one of the things I like to try to show in the book is, you know, you see a lot of books in the same genre where there's a cause of, you know, society's collapse. The economy goes to crap and society collapses. There's an earthquake or a volcano or an EMP or some other event and, you know, society falls apart. But I believe people are really resilient. You know, you see hundreds, you know, you see dozens, if not hundreds of localized events across the world every year. Hurricanes, typhoons, earthquakes, you know, war, you name it. But, you know, normalcy usually, except for maybe in the case of, you know, decade-long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, normalcy usually comes back a couple weeks, if not months, after a earthquake or hurricane. You know, but what happens when the government is already faltering because inflation's too high, you know, you're out of oil? One of the things that kind of feeds the side story in the book is they went to the extreme of trying to ease oil prices by releasing the national strategic reserves. And so when they actually needed to tap into that, they're bone dry and they can't even mount a recovery effort, really. But I try to bring in the kind of like the dual or even triple factor of what happens when you're already suffering through something, kind of like the way we are now. I feel like right now in our country's history, we'd be extra susceptible to some sort of natural disaster.
Because we're using all of the tools that we have available to dig ourselves out of this. And I think some would say that we're using some of those tools too much in the way of quantitative easing and flooding the money supply, at a rate of about 10%. I think M2 is $10 trillion, and we're printing 85 billion every month, which is just over $1 trillion a year that we're adding to the M2 money supply. So that's about a 10% increase in the total money supply every year. And Mr. Bernanke's pledged to do that through, I think, at least 2015. They were talking about tapering it, but there's no way they could taper it because everything's built on that funny money. Whatever they want to call a recovery, which I think we talked a little bit about before, that it wouldn't really be a recovery if you took out that quantitative easing, that $1 trillion. GDP is roughly $15 trillion. If that's about 7% of GDP, so if you subtracted 7% from that, then the real number would be, we just released the first quarter GDP for this year was 2.4%. So if you subtract 7% from that, then you've got negative 4.6. So
right,
that'd be much closer to a depression than a recovery. But confidence is the lifeblood of markets. So whatever you can get the people to believe, that's kind of going to gauge their actions if you can get them to believe
right.
a lie.
Right. Yeah, and there's a chart that I'll look up and I'll send over to you from the market ticker that kind of shows the GDP over the past few years minus federal spending.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and it shows, you know, not only when we went negative, we actually went really negative. Not only are we, you know, we're barely positive now at the headline number, but if you back out, you know, the deficit spending, we're big time negative.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. And my favorite thing is, you know, like you're saying, not only are they printing this money, but it's going through the primary dealers who are skimming right off the top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I'm going to plug, you know, my cause of Free John Corzine, to you know, help get him out of jail for his failed, you know, MF Global scheme that he ran. Google it.
All right, I'll do that. too big to jail. They're all too big to jail, right? I think Holder said that we couldn't prosecute the heads of Goldman because to do so would be systemically unstabilizing, something like that. So I guess we went from too big to fail to too big to jail.
And right.
And then we've consolidated. We took these too big to fail banks and we consolidated them into bigger banks. So I guess now we've got too big to bail because there'd just be no
right.
saving them next time.
Well, and you look at you see all these numbers for like the shadow derivatives and stuff that they still are, you know, keeping off the books in the hundreds of trillions of dollars.
I've heard of numbers like a quadrillion.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I've got, there's a link on Prepper Recon at the top of the page under economic links, and there's a visualization of what $1 trillion looks like, and it's approximately, a football field full of pallets of $100 bills stacked too high, and that's $1 trillion. So,
wow.
$1 quadrillion is 1,000 bills.
It goes to the moon, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe that's their plan. You know, the people keep talking about making a space elevator. They're just going to make it out of pallets of $100 bills.
Yeah, we can do that. But they don't even print it anymore. It's just, they just put another zero in the computer. That's there. And then another thing we see in the book is that you just mentioned is the resource scarcity, peak oil or at least peak cheap oil.
Right. And that's, so to back it up just a little bit is, if you like prepper books, one thing I don't like to get into is a lot of how to, you know, my favorite book, you know, is Patriots by James Rawls. Amazing book. It's kind of like a how to book.
Yeah, it is.
I don't get into a lot of, how to because I want my book to kind of be more of a thought provoking cross genre. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about how fancy somebody's gun is or all these neat things, although I do a little bit because I want people to be able to take this book and give it to somebody who's on the fence or somebody, give it to your liberal friends and be like, hey, this is what can happen. You know, I don't want it to be a how to of how to turn people off from prepping. You know, it's kind of a cross genre is where I'm trying to go. Hopefully I succeed a little bit to maybe help open people's eyes. Sorry, I went off on a little tangent.
No, that's good. That's good because, and like you said, James Rawls has already done a really, really good job at that. So why reinvent the wheel? So that's kind of what sets yours is a different book. And that's great.
Yeah. I wouldn't even just say the wheel. He's got kind of like the, you know, the Z6 Corvette sitting right there. It's
great. Yeah. He invented the whole thing there, didn't he? They call him the godfather of prepping. So.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, you look at the inflation, which is something that's happening to everybody right now. You look at peak oil, There's a lot of resources out there that are very reputable that say we hit it or we're going to hit it, you know, plus or minus 2 years. A lot of them that I see say minus 2 years ago, you know, back in 2011, 2012, we hit peak oil. Mm-hmm. Most people don't understand peak oil. Mm-hmm. I'm going to guess most of the listeners here do, mm-hmm. but most people don't, because they think when you say peak oil, they think of Mad Max and they think of hokey movies like that, that, you know, you have the road warrior racing up and down the street, looting gangs. Peak oil just means it's half gone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, or it's the ability to extract it is going to start going down. So we've got a consumption, world consumption that's ramping up into a production that's slowly dwindling down. You know, how do we manage that? You know, the U.S. uses a quarter of all the oil in the world. And I can't remember right off the top of my head, but we're not even a double digit of the population. You know, it's, you've got a middle class or even a lower class and upper class in China that's, you know, multiple times the size of the U.S. You look at India and, you know, a dozen other countries around the world that are, you know, coming up trying to come up to a U.S. kind of standard. There's just literally not enough oil.
Mm-hmm. I think it's about 300 million in America, our population. Mm-hmm. I think it's about a billion in China, and I think it's close to a billion in India. So, yeah, if all of those guys want to start driving around in a F-150 and like the Americans, then yeah, we're gonna go through a lot of oil.
Yeah, and that's another thing. Going back to kind of like the crash course, is he does a really good example of explaining it. Not only peak oil, but he explains it as energy returned on your energy invested.
Yes.
And he uses the example of, you know, 100 years ago when they first discovered oil, it was literally bubbling up out of the ground in California.
Oh yeah, like the Beverly Hillbillies where Jeb Clampett goes out and he's shooting at a rabbit and oil starts popping out of the ground. Yeah, those days are over. Now we got to go 100 miles offshore, drill down for a mile, and then turn a corner and then drill horizontally for another mile out in the middle of the ocean.
Yep. So that's he shows these graphs where, you know, 100 years ago, for every barrel's worth of energy you used, you got about 100 barrels back. Mm-hmm. You know, 20 years ago was still a good multiple. And now I think it's not even a 2-to-1 ratio. I think it's somewhere close to, it takes about a barrel of oil to get 1.6 or 1.7 barrels. I'll look that up and we can put that in the notes, but it's your rate of return is getting much lower.
And then when the gas prices go up, then the price of delivering consumer goods goes up because you got there on a truck that uses gas, and it's most of the consumer goods are wrapped in plastic that was made from petroleum. Plastic's a petroleum product.
Right. And it's multiple levels, you know, not just your food going to the store, but, you know, it being grown, you know, especially when you're looking at, you know, going back to the beef example, it's like, you know, I'd hate to know how much, you know, petroleum goes into raising the feed for the cows. They actually use a lot of petroleum to, you know, the mass amounts of pesticides, the mass amounts of, fertilizer. That's exactly it. Because I was going to say there's a study I saw not too long ago that says we reached peak phosphate, which is, if not that's like the second most important fertilizer a decade ago.
Wow.
What are we going to do? We are more dependent upon, you know, chemical fertilizers, and we already went over the peak of it. You know, they're able to strip mine more of it out of the ground, or I'm not exactly for sure how they, I think it's potash. I'm not sure exactly how they get it, but they showed that, you know, we reached the peak a decade ago.
Mm-hmm. But it keeps getting more and more expensive and labor intensive to mm-hmm. mine out of the ground.
And that's why one of the things that I'm trying to get into, and, you know, so my publishing company that I started for the novel and the next novels is actually called Abundant Future Media, because I really want to get into, I'm working on it. I've been a farmer all my life. I grew up on a produce farm in southern Indiana.
Oh, awesome.
And I really want to get, but it was a commercial farm. You know, we used a lot of petroleum products. We used plasticulture. So we were using petroleum plastic to keep weeds out and water in and all that stuff. But what happens when all that goes away? You know, so I'm really trying to get into the whole permaculture movement. And you know, how can we do this sustainably?
Yeah. And then another theme that I saw in the book just within the first chapter is that, John and Margaret are having a discussion about how they're going to maintain their standard of living with inflation going up and everything.
Right.
And so how are they? Are they pretty physically responsible? Do we find that out in the book?
Yeah, they're pretty physically responsible. You know, I tried to kind of mirror some of their fiscal responsibility after myself in real life. I tried to not do a whole lot of the real life stuff, but I wanted to paint them as fiscally responsible, where actually, Margaret's the wife who was the main breadwinner. John's an engineer. So like they're upper middle class is the way I try to portray them, living in a nice neighborhood. But they've worked their finances that to the point where that when Margaret's laid off at her job, they really don't have to take a lifestyle hit, mm-hmm. even though she's not making an income anymore. Whereas you see most people in the U.S., once again, I keep apologizing to the listeners. They'll probably get tired of me doing that, but, you look at people up and down my street, up and down your street. If you're out in the boonies, the people in the town you go shopping at, you know, how much debt do they have? You know, it's astounding when you start to talk to people how much of their lifestyle is funded on debt. You know, whether it's, you know, home loans, credit card loans, the average credit card debt in the U.S. is, I don't remember what it is, but it was shocking when I saw that. Mm-hmm. And then I started talking to some of our personal friends, like, oh yeah, I've got $35,000 of credit card debt. It's like,
wow.
But you don't even make $35,000 a year.
Oh my goodness.
And they have a brand new car.
Oh.
That they rolled their last car's debt into their new one because, you know, you go to, your Ally financing and it doesn't matter if you owe $10,000 on your car that's worth $6,000, they'll roll it into your next one. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, fiscal responsibility is key because, you know, if not, you know, an earthquake happens, a hurricane happens, or some other disaster happens, you know, that's an unknown. What you do know is we're going to have high inflation because we're living it right now. We're going to have, you know, increased, you know, petroleum costs and decreased availability. Those are mathematical certainties. So you've really got to be able to manage your finances in a way that you're resilient.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the key to prepping or just common sense, but especially if things get worse, if you've already taken steps to cut back, then when the crisis does come, number one, you're going to have a cushion from not spending everything that you made from living below your means. And number two, you're going to feel it less because you've already stepped back your standard of living to a sustainable point. So if you're spending 20% less than what you make and you get a 20% income reduction, now you're living at your means and you could actually still sustain that and live off the cushion
right.
that you've saved.
Right. And that you see it popped around a lot of the financial sites I frequent. It's like the number of or the amount of dollars that the average American has saved is like -600 or something like that.
Wow.
Or maybe it's 600. Maybe I'm just, dreaming that up, but it's, you know, most people and they'll show studies all the time. If they don't get their next paycheck, they're in trouble.
Yeah.
Paycheck to paycheck is the way the majority of the U.S. lives. And it's a horrible way. I mean, you know, my wife and I are set up right now that, you know, the only debt we have is our mortgage and we're going to have that paid off in about 4 years. You know, if everything holds together, you know, I keep both our jobs, it'll be about 4 years. To do that, we haven't had a car payment in about 5 years. I drive a car that's, I think 17 years old, 150,000 miles on it. Whereas, it's probably the second most beat up car in our neighborhood. You know, we have 16-year-olds on our street that are driving, you know, brand new cars that are,
yeah.
you know, but they're all financed by debt. You know, what happens?
They're starting them out right.
Absolutely.
Very good.
But just being fiscally responsible and how can you do that, is, you know that this is happening. You know that inflation's coming. You know that, you know, well, you don't know if you're going to have a job. You don't know if you're going to be able to get all the things you need. So, you know, being in debt is just one more thing that is a, you know, it's like a big rock on your shoulders that you have to try and get out of.
Yeah. So will there be a sequel to The Wayward Journey?
It is in process right now. So there is a part two and a part three planned. Part two should be out hopefully at the, I'm aiming for the end of August. That's a little, ambitious for me. And part three will be hopefully before Christmas. But yeah, they are in process, and hopefully if you like the first one, I think you'd really like the second one. It's got some more of the side story that really gets, you know, interesting and kind of think about it. So for the listener's explanation, if you look at it, you can actually see each chapter is started out with a radio or TV broadcast that kind of gives you a description of what's happening in the world. And I tried to model that as much around what I really think would happen. And does it go off on the worst case scenario? I think it does, but it's a plausible worst case scenario. So you have that portion of each chapter, and then you have the story that follows John, Margaret, and the other people around them, which is kind of like the main theme. But in book two, there's some really, I think they're neat. Hopefully the readers will think they're neat too, of world events that will be played out that, you know, some people will say that's crazy, or some people will say, that's crazy, and just because it could happen.
Yeah. So where can the folks find you? Are you on Facebook?
Yep, I'm on Facebook. You can just Facebook/Nathan Hale Jefferson. You can find the books on Amazon. You can also see my website. There's not too terribly much, but there is a link to the first, I think about first 100 pages, first 40% of the book on my website, abundantfuture.net.
All right, we'll have links to your Facebook fan page. We'll also have a link to Abundant Future. And you can also purchase The Wayward Journey through Amazon on today's page. We'll have a link to purchase it straight through the page.
Great.
And then of course if you buy something from the book through Amazon, I'm sure Nathan would appreciate it if you leave a review on Amazon. I know that helps authors a lot.
Yep, any reviews you can give. If you really, really hate it, maybe you just email me the review so I can know what I can do better the next time. But I don't really want to undo influence anybody. You know, it's a review of the book. If you like it, great. If you don't, great. But you can also email me online if there's things that you think I got wrong or think you'd like to see in the future. Email me, NathanHaleJefferson@gmail.com, or just contact me on the Facebook page.
Nathan, thanks again for taking time to come on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mark. It was great to be here.
Thank you. An economic storm is headed our way. The die has been cast. We must spread the word and prepare. The coming collapse will bring a contest between tyranny and freedom. If the patriot is to prevail, we must stand as one, pledge allegiance to our God, and defend the Constitution. If you are new to prepping or would like to learn more, read our 7-step survival plan. You can find it under categories on the left-hand side of our website. Thanks for listening to the Prepper Recon podcast. God bless, and happy prepping.